You are listening to Agriculture, a podcast that aims to explore the stories of the people that make up our agricultural industry and culture of farming in Scotland and beyond. On today's episode...
I left Scotland very much with this idea that people were quite against farming. And then I started travelling and you start seeing some of the wider issues that are happening around the world. Sometimes we perpetuate that idea of that vilification. Often the minority that are quite critical of farming, they're a minority, but they're loud, very clever in their marketing, and that can be taken as a much higher volume than it actually is, and that's what we hear and we often respond to. But the majority are very supportive, and there is such a value and respect and trust, particularly in farming. That is probably the thing. It's who we're directing messages to when we're sending them out. Adapting the language so it's accessible and not leaving people out of those conversations. Engaging, not educating, and then moving out of those circles so we're not always just speaking to ourselves. Everybody can do it in different ways. I think cumulatively we can all do a little bit more, bring that connection a little bit closer together again.
I'm Mary Jane Laurie, and in this episode I'm joined by Claire Taylor. Claire is a journalist and describes herself as an agricultural communicator. She has recently finished her travels as part of her Nuffield Farming Scholarship and is now in the process of compiling all the information from her travels. We talk about her career and how that led her to applying for the scholarship, what she learned from it, and how we as farmers can work together to engage with the public to tell positive farming stories. She shares with us some of her amazing experiences from her travels and gives us a real insight into what farming is like in other countries. Warning, this episode contains themes of political unrest, suicide, gender-based violence and murder. Listen with caution. Good morning, Claire. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Morning.
So this podcast aims to tell the story of people in farming in Scotland and beyond, which sounds basically exactly like what your job is. So you describe yourself as an agriculture communicator. What do you mean by that?
Oh, an agricultural communicator, which is a self-styled name that I seem to have given myself, Mary Jane. I guess over the last 5 or 6 years, I've been a journalist working in farming, and then I've progressed through that into more kind of columns and a bit of commentating on the BBC and different things. So I sort of became slightly more of a kind of agricultural communicator of lots of different topics and issues. And I always say I'm a bit of a jack of all trades and a master of none. I know a little bit about lots of subjects in agriculture, but I definitely am not a specialist.
So tell us a little bit about your background in agriculture then.
So I come from a very small beef farm on the west coast of Scotland, just outside Ayr. We've got belted Galloway cattle. It's actually not the mainstay of the operation. My parents run a kennels and cattery, and we have the belted Galloways too. And I've come from a family of vets, actually. And for me, farming really wasn't where I was headed work-wise, even though I grew up in that and that was a real interest. And I spent all my childhood and time when I was at university on the farm. It really wasn't until my mid-20s that I even look at anything within agriculture.
So what did you study at university then?
So I studied politics and international relations at Edinburgh University, and that's really where I was headed. So I was always interested in more that kind of international focus, but it was more on international aid and okay. Working in the third sector. So that was really where I was sort of gearing up to for all those years.
And then so what was your first job out of university?
So my first job was working at the BBC. So I spent a year, I graduated when I was 21, and I did a year of unpaid internships, like so many of us do. I was very lucky. Lots of friends that let me stay for free and on the couch and in different rooms. Gosh. But I moved to London, did lots of work down there, mostly in the third sector. And then I realised it probably wasn't going to be where I ended up working. And that's when people had said, what about media? I'd love public speaking at school. I liked writing. And I started doing some work experience at different radio stations. And then I got a role as a trainee sports reporter at BBC Scotland during the Commonwealth Games. And also when the referendum was following only a couple of months later. And that ended up being my first paid gig. So that was, I was at 22 and I was working at the BBC in their politics department.
That must have been quite an exciting first job. I know you had your year of interning for free. That's a pretty good first job to get. That was like a time a lot of political turmoil and stuff. What was that role like?
It was absolutely amazing because, like I said, I started off in sport And part of the reason I think I got the internship was I'd been trying to get into the Commonwealth Games as a hurdler, as an athlete.
Oh, wow.
I didn't quite make the selection for that, but I think that really stood out on my application. But once I got into the BBC and realised I had absolutely no background in football and other kind of the main sports they covered, I'd sort of been meeting with some of the news team and say, you know, recognising all the hype and the build up to the referendum, and having done a politics degree, I was so interested in what was going on. So to move into the referendum unit, and I actually, that role specifically, I was a researcher on what was called the big debate. We had to organise thousands of school children to come to the Hydro, because at that point they'd lowered the voting age to 16, 17 year olds. So it was a really exciting time for that kind of younger engagement in politics. So I was really getting to speak to a lot of young people and interview them and sort of pick the audiences for that. And then I sort of, for the next few years, we had a lot of elections in Scotland and the UK. We had local, we had general elections. We then went on to have Brexit. So I actually worked on elections, not as a journalist, I moved up to being a producer for a number of years, actually. So a really interesting time. And when you've done a politics degree, it is quite exciting to be, you know, at the centre of an organisation which is covering everything. And the newsroom is just, it just came alive with all the reporters, and you'd have Reporting Scotland in the evenings and the mornings. It was a really incredible place to work.
How did you then move from politics back into agriculture?
So I was always really interested in agricultural stories, and I felt after Brexit, so in 2016, for the next year, I did another year at the BBC after that, I just felt there wasn't a huge amount of attention and coverage on farming issues, but even on the rural side as well. I felt a lot of the debates I was organising were very central belt focused, and I remember always trying to look, could we get some of our debates into Dumfries and Galloway? Can we go up to Orkney? And I was always really interested in actually widening the focus of the issues we were covering. And I just wasn't overly content. I remember a colleague of mine has sent me an advert for the Scottish Farmer and said, Claire, this could be a great job for you. And she's like, I know you're not a journalist. You'd be able to get your teeth into something and actually start actually working on farming issues. I'm always forever grateful to this woman, Annie Maguire, who sent this over to me. Mm-hmm. And I did. I left a very comfortable job, and I was about to move into actually more on screen stuff. They were sort of piloting me a little bit to look at going on screen and doing reporting. And I just left and I took a bit of a risk, and I joined the Scottish Farmer with absolutely no writing experience, no journalism experience, but having known the newsroom and knowing politics. And I guess for me, I thought, well, if I come to the Scottish Farmer, maybe I can use some of that politics background to really engage more politicians and to get them interested in farming issues and have more of a dialogue. So that's what my kind of thoughts were there. So, but it was a bit of a baptism of fire, because yes, I had a background in beef cattle, but that was really it. I had a respect and a value of farming. I understood the pressures, the challenges. I read the Scottish Farmer, but I didn't really know what was ahead of me. So it was, 25 I started there.
And have you been there ever since, or have you had other roles since then?
So I was at the Scottish Farmer for 4.5 years, and I worked up to being their politics editor. Absolutely loved my job. I mean, it was just a dream to be on the ground meeting people across the country. And it was a great role because you met everybody. So you met farmers, you met agronomists, I met consultants, advisors, auctioneers, hauliers. You began to really understand the complexity of the supply chain. And it was just the dream job, because you felt quite disconnected when I was at the BBC. You're not really speaking to, maybe it's the wrong word, but real people. You kind of speak to yourselves, and you have people coming in into studios, but you don't actually hear what's going on, boots on the ground. Whereas the Scottish Farmer were wonderful in that way, because you got out and you understood what was happening and you built this network. And I just found farmers in general particularly wonderful to work with, and very trusting and very respectful, because I think journalism had a bit of a bad name, does have a bad name. And I was always incredibly critical of journalism and said I'd never be a journalist. I thought it was quite salacious. I thought it was invasive. I always thought the idea of hounding people for stories, because that's often what we see. And I always said I'll never be a journalist in that respect. But it was totally different when you're a farming journalist, because you do care about the industry and you want what's best for them. So I felt it was a role I could be really proud of. So I absolutely loved working there 4.5 years. It was hard with COVID, because like a lot of people, roles like mine, which were traditionally more desk-based plus then interviewing, we couldn't go out and meet people.
Yeah.
And that was hard. And when you're trying to do a feature on someone, and I did a lot of features around mental health and well-being, like having those really personal, intimate interviews and you're not in person with somebody, to me, that it really kind of caused a disconnection and detachment. And I just fell out a little bit of my love of my job at that point. And I had been approached to work in communications and marketing. And I thought, well, maybe it's a really good time to expand my skill set and learn a different role. And people think sometimes if you're not in journalism or communications and marketing, people sometimes might mix them up a little bit. They are actually quite different. And as a journalist, you rely so much on people working in communications and PR. They do wonderful jobs. So it's great for me to understand the other side and the people who are bringing you great stories and introducing you to clients. So I did that for about a year and a half before I started my Nuffield Farming Scholarship. And since then, I've been really focusing on that as my main role, doing columns and different things on the side, but that has been my main focus.
I was just about to ask you about your Nuffield Farming Scholarship. So those that haven't heard about what Nuffield Farming Scholarships are, can you tell us a little bit about the programme?
Yeah, of course. So Nuffield Farming Scholarship programme, it's really aimed at getting individuals to travel to different parts of the world and to immerse themselves in different environments, cultures, farming practices, policies, and just to really be listening and learning and picking up ideas to then bring back to the UK, to here in Scotland, and to look at how can we, could be improving your own business, it could be giving back to the industry, and just, it's really about that kind of knowledge exchange, but on a really global level. Because I think a lot of times there's so much going on, particularly in farming, it's endless and a lot of things are out of your control, but you don't always have the opportunities to step out and actually have those kind of open eyes and open ears to learn. And it's a really invaluable opportunity to do that. So it's been quite incredible.
Who can apply for a scholarship?
So who can apply? I believe there's an age limit. So I believe it's between 25 and 45 years old. And it can be anybody that has an interest within agriculture, and now that aquaculture is covered within that, there's a lot of people within backgrounds in woodland and forestry. So it's that idea, it's slightly more broad, it's more diverse and people. So you don't have to actually be actively working on the ground as a farmer. I do think that's really important that they maintain every year people doing that, because I think that's really important. Sometimes there's been criticism, it can be moving away. It's people that have a real stake in the industry and in the natural environment. That's who they're looking for.
And do you know how many scholarships they offer per year? Is it just one, or is there a group of you apply at the same time?
So my year group in 2023, there were 19 of us.
Oh, wow.
And there were four from Scotland, which was really, really fantastic. This year, 2024 year, there has been, I believe, 24 and a couple from Scotland. So the majority are in England. They adjust it every year, and it's often down to sponsorship as well. I'm very generously supported by RAS, so they're my sponsor. And it just depends a bit on more organisations sponsoring this journey as well. And that must depend on how many they bring on.
Did you approach the Nuffield Farming Scholarship with the theme that you wanted to explore, or do they advertise certain themes that they might be particularly interested in one year? How does it all work in that regard?
When I applied, it was based on, I'd say, two things. It's based on you as a candidate and in terms of what you can deliver and give back to Nuffield if you're going to be a good ambassador, a good potential leader. So that was half of it. And the other half is your topic. And so, yeah, I applied with a topic. And I think a lot of people who are looking at Nuffield get put off by that because they're worried about, is this the right thing? And I guess if anyone's listening who is interested, people change. They've got to stick to a kind of broad area or a passion, but you're able to change and as you move along. And that's the point of the scholarship. You know, you travel and you suddenly are confronted with something totally different. It's only right that you should be able to change. So it's about having that brief idea of what you want to deliver, whether it's personally or for the sector more widely. For my topic, for years when I was at the Scottish Farmer, I would speak at events, particularly, I'd probably say post-Brexit. Of course, it was all post-Brexit when I was there. But it was very much the case with the mixture of Brexit, and then the climate agenda was really accelerating in the few years I was working there. And a lot of farmers felt they were coming under fire. And they would say to me, the media are against us. And because my background is the BBC, they'd always be very curious and ask me what I thought of the BBC and how they were framing farming. So, and I kept hearing the phrase is an anti-farming agenda. Mm-hmm. So I was like, when I was went to apply for Nuffield, for me, it was like, well, is there an anti-farming agenda around the world? How is it changing? Has it got worse? How are we helping ourselves as farmers to maybe combat that? So I did, my title was Turning the Tide on the Anti-Farming Agenda. And I've kept my title. I have a slightly different view on that when I present it in November this year in Belfast, which is at the Nuffield Conference. In 2 years' time, you present your findings. Okay. But that is what I applied with. And that's when I had my interview. I think I had 12 minutes. So I sat in my interview and they literally have a stopwatch and they fire questions at you and you have to be concise. Yeah, you got to be really concise and answer kind of very quickly, very to the point. And it's pretty tough. They put you under pressure. But if you're passionate and you care about what you're doing, I actually liked my interview because it kind of reignited something in me that I was like, this is really what I want to do. And I'm needing to grow and to learn and to go and explore this. So I actually really embraced my interview. Not that everyone will, but I just think it's a great opportunity to show that you care about what you're trying to do.
So you had to go in super prepared then, if 12 minutes. It's not a long time. I mean, it's, for some people, that might sound quite a long time, but if people are asking you questions in that time to formulate answers, I guess you have to be really prepared and really know where you want your research to go. But I guess as you were getting into the project and getting started, direction of travel probably has changed a little bit, hasn't it, about what you've been exploring?
Totally, because I guess I left Scotland very much with this idea that people were quite against farming. They were quite anti-farming because that was in my bubble, because I'm very much part of an echo chamber in the work that I was doing. And then I started traveling and you start seeing some of the wider issues that are happening around the world. The conversation levels are they're just very different. So you begin to realize that sometimes we perpetuate that idea of that vilification because we do that amongst ourselves. And I know a lot of people listening will probably agree with this, but often the minority that are quite critical of farming, they're a minority, but they're loud and they often have the ear of government as well. They can be very tactical, very clever in their marketing, and that can be taken as a much higher volume than it actually is. And that's what we hear and we often respond to. But the majority are very supportive. And I think I've seen surveys, I've spoken to people around the world, and there is such a value and respect and trust, particularly in farming. I mean, obviously, I was covering everything. I was speaking to vets, I was speaking to politicians, journalists, agronomists, researchers, everybody. But actually in farmers on the ground, the level of trust is astronomical. And that's something that I've definitely taken away. We're not being very good at actually seeing that because sometimes we don't spend enough time actually out with our own familiar circles to realize what those perspectives are.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And especially with farming, it can be quite an isolated job and you might just socialize with other farmers, particularly at busy times of years, like we've just come through lambing and calving and busy arable spring work. So I guess if you're just head down on focused on work, it can maybe sometimes feel like, you know, you're just within that bubble, as you say. It's interesting that you were talking about all the different people that you spoke to on your travels. How do you even begin to plan where you're going? Because I read that you've been to 14 countries. So you've got your topic idea of what you're going to talk about and what you're going to research. How do you pick where you're going to go? How do you figure out who you're going to speak to? How does it all work?
It's quite a complicated journey, I guess, because when you do your application, they ask you where you're going to travel. And I remember sitting down and thinking, I have absolutely no idea, because almost every country has to have a conversation about agriculture.
Yeah.
Right. So I was like, where do I begin? And there was certain things that stuck out to me. Like I knew there'd been lots of protests happening in the Netherlands. I'm actually heading there shortly to have conversations about that. And I knew, for example, in New Zealand that under the last government, there'd been a particularly aggressive agenda when it came to accelerating sort of climate action, which I knew a lot of farmers I'd just been hearing from people were quite struggling with. So there's a couple of places that I knew about, but really I didn't have much of an idea. And what really helped me was for every Nuffield scholar, you have a week where you meet all scholars from around the world. So I went to Canada for 6 days and in Vancouver, and it was a conference, but really you're not really there I'll be honest with you, Mary Jane, I didn't learn too much about Canada when I was there because you had 90 people from around the world, and I mean every continent represented. Yeah. I spent my time not even networking, just building relationships with people, hearing about their countries, their realities. And that's where, for me, I was like, well, I knew straight away there, you know, some of the places I wanted to go. So when I was there, I met some people from Zimbabwe, and I had always been interested in Zimbabwe around land reform. Mm-hmm. Just that whole conversation, it's very complicated. It's very emotional. So I knew that would be interesting. And then I bumped into someone from who'd said there was a conference happening in Tanzania. So you begin to piece together ideas via one or two contacts. And then you think, right, I'm going to follow up on that. And that's literally what I did. So you have to be quite open to being like saying yes and just taking a bit of a risk a little bit. Yeah. So I got guided by a lot of people. And one of the best trips I had was in Tasmania in Australia. A really good friend of mine who's just been here in Scotland, Joanna, she called me one day because she heard me in a podcast. And she said, Claire, I love your topic. You've got to come to Tasmania and you've got to look at the salmon industry, because there's some really big conflicts happening here. And I can introduce, she worked for a group called the Tassel Group. It's one of the biggest salmon producers in Australia. And she was like, I'll introduce you to some of our lobbying bodies and you can look at how they're overcoming some of the narratives around salmon farming. I thought, how amazing is that? So I just said, yes. I said, I'm going to come to Tasmania. I'm going to look at salmon farming and look at a different sector. And I did. And I knew at that point, Tasmania was in the cards. I thought, well, Australia will be on the wider Australia. And from there, I sort of then started looking for people and piecing things together. But sometimes you would have that diamond, kind of that real diamond that would reach out or mention to you, and you just sort of piece the puzzle around it. And the Nuffield Network, I probably have to, I mean, that's really important to mention. It's like this open book that you can, once you're a member, you can go into the database and I can type in Zimbabwe, Argentina, or wherever I'm going, wherever there's got an established Nuffield Network. And you can actually filter by region, by sector, anything. And you'll have scholars from over the last 80, 90 years. And you can, they'll have their contacts, addresses. So they will then be a great starting point. So you're never completely on your own. Yeah. If you go to countries without an Nuffield Network, which I did, that's more complicated. And I mean, I was really lucky, actually. It was SSE Consulting, Robert Ramsey. Yeah. He put me in touch with a really great guy in Argentina who then organized my entire trip in Argentina for me.
Amazing.
So I didn't have to think about it, whereas yeah. other trips I had, I was actually quite stressed, you know, thinking of places to go. So you rely on people, things like LinkedIn, and just being really, I think people are getting more active on social media now, and they reach out and say what they're doing. And people are very good and they want to have you there because people are proud of their countries, they're proud of their farming systems. And that's a really lovely thing that they want to invite you in.
So you mentioned there about the sort of salmon farming. So that's one of your visits that you did. And you just talked there about Argentina. What did you do in Argentina?
So Argentina, goodness me, I arrived in Argentina and I ended up the first weekend I stayed with this amazing couple in their 80s who had an Arab stud for Arab horses, and they worked on a farm there. I saw lots of beef farming and went to an amazing farmer's market, one of the biggest, most incredible things I've ever seen there. I think they sold something like 11,000 cattle in an hour and a half.
Oh my goodness.
So the scale of it was, and just how they would operate an auction mart in a very different way that we would. So it was just really, you're kind of observing and seeing lots of things at the same time.
Did they still have an auctioneer standing up speaking a whole lot of really fast words that nobody can actually understand?
They had about six auctioneers in different segments, and they'd ring a bell. Like I'm gesticulating a bell right now and no one can see me, but they would literally start ringing a bell and you'd have 30 seconds to get to this area of the stand, and there would be just groups of up to 40 cattle in each pen. And the auctioneer was basically in like a little cart, and he or she would just be pulled along and they would just move between these lots of cattle. So you understand why it goes so quickly.
Yeah.
But the most amazing thing about the market, about the mart, was that everything was done on horseback. So you just had all these gauchos in traditional dress, and they were moving all the cattle and opening gates. It was just like, it was an absolute art to watch it. And then they were, you know, you'd see all the gauchos moving the cattle, you'd see them then getting them onto the trucks to leave, and all of this in an hour and a half. And it was just, it was a really, and all the animals were very calm. They obviously were really used to the horses. So just really cool to watch something like that.
Yeah, something totally different. And that's quite smart, actually, isn't it? Moving the auctioneer rather than having to bring all the cattle through the ring every time. You can see how that would speed things up. And you mentioned also that you went to Zimbabwe. What was life like there? Because I know they've had a lot of political unrest, haven't they, as well? What's the attitude of the farmers over there?
Zimbabwe is a really complicated story because I knew a little bit. I knew about what I'd seen in papers, what I learned a little bit at university in my course. But I arrived there wanting to understand, because agriculture and in general in Zimbabwe was thriving in the sort of late 1900s. They were like the breadbasket of Africa. They were major exporters of beef. And then in the early 2000s, the then President Robert Mugabe, he tried to, I can't remember the actual term for it, but I remember he called an election where he would have been able to be a leader forever, basically. I'm sorry, I'm getting my words wrong there. But the vote had gone against him. And the sort of, I guess what I picked up when I was there, he sort of, it was very much blamed on those on white farmers in agricultural areas because he was able to work out where the vote was and where it came from. And what had happened was then there was a campaign, a sort of tirade against white farmers. And I can't remember the figures exactly, but thousands and thousands of people left in the first few weeks, just evacuated the country. And those that stayed behind, because as any farmers listening would imagine, you know that you farmed those lands for such a long time, you're proud of them. They didn't want to leave. But then there was obviously a campaign where farmers were, they were murdered, tortured. It was horrendous. And I heard lots of those stories. So I met with farmers who had been kicked off the land, who'd lost family members, who'd seen some of the most horrendous things I've ever been told. And I've heard sad things as a journalist, but that trip really affected me because, first of all, they were quite open with me and they shared really intimate, difficult experiences. But then I guess the point for my topic is it was about resilience and how they'd been able to overcome something a lot of us can even begin to imagine, being kicked off because they lost livestock, they lost everything. They'd go from being quite, there was a lot of farmers who were very wealthy, went from having everything to nothing in a few hours, a lot of them, but they were able to come back and rebuild. So in Zimbabwe still, you wouldn't have white farmers owning land. That still does not happen, but there's a lot of white farmers as managers. So it was just understanding, you know, why would they come back and how has agriculture changed in that time? And a lot of the soils have been neglected. They are infertile and there is amazing work going on and looking at regen that I looked at when I was there, but trying to rebuild the agricultural landscape. And I spoke to so many people and I thought it was going to be all sad stories, but actually there was still such a sense of pride in Zimbabwe and in rebuilding the agricultural nation that it once was. And so I went with thinking it was all going to be negative. Actually, it wasn't. There was still very much that hope for the future, that optimism. And one of the most amazing people that I met when I was there was a former chief inspector in the police, a guy called Israel Mantutu. So again, another completely random introduction I was given. He actually came into the police force in the independence war. So that was in 1980. And then he went through in the police force the next 25 years. And he explained to me about racial tensions in the country and what it was like as a black police officer working with white farmers and some of those tensions of government. And then he left the police force and then he joined a major farming business over there, which is this particular pig business. They produce 60% of the pork in Zimbabwe. And that's how I got meeting him. And he is like head of public relations and he's got great contacts in police and government. And they were able to, because he was involved and with them, their farm was never taken over because he was when people came to the gates and they were beating their drums and saying they were going to remove all the farmers, he was able to pull in his contacts and everything. So it was a very unusual story, but it gave me such an insight into someone who's been through different phases of the country's history. And he's a really good relationship with farmers and with government and policy. So you just begin to have these phenomenal conversations as you go.
It sounds really tough. And just the resilience that the farmers in Zimbabwe must have had, you know, not just the white farmers that have remained, but the farmers that were then brought in to take over the farms. And I guess with clearing out all the white farmers, they lose a lot of knowledge that way as well. And you were saying about some of the farms and the soils not being fertile anymore. You've lost the knowledge of the people that farmed the land, but also we've got this added climate crisis going on as well. So I guess Zimbabwe's, is it one of the countries that's suffering from the climate emergency more than others, would you say, that you visited?
I don't know if I would say more than others, because I didn't probably get into that detail as much because it was more of a sort of, it was more the social side that I looked at when I was there. I guess the conversations were around gender and poverty and different things, but they definitely are struggling. And you're absolutely right, Mary Jane, that knowledge transfer. And that was one of the things that Ijoma Ntutu said to me, that if he'd done it differently, he would have made sure there was that mentoring or that exchange of knowledge. But then there's a deep history there around racism in Zimbabwe as well. And it wasn't just white commercial farmers that were kicked off the land. Lots of them had black workers who were very loyal and supportive. And a lot of them were murdered and killed as well because they showed allegiance or loyalty. So I think it's not a sort of one versus the other. It's a very nuanced conversation that often gets missed. And for me, I was able to really experience that from speaking to people from different, not different sides, but from different perspectives of everything that happened from the climate side. You're absolutely right, because the land that was given away, it wasn't given to farmers at all, and which is so difficult because nobody knew how to work the land. And they are completely depleted. Their topsoil, they don't have anything. So they're having to now start from zero at the same time when they have got rising temperatures, all these other issues against them. So it's a much more complicated place to begin. But then they're also trying to grow knowledge, and they're trying to do all the things that we're already very ahead on. So they're having to start again, but have bigger climate pressures on top. And that was something I did see across Africa. Obviously, Zimbabwe was different in that story. But when I was in Kenya and Tanzania as well, a lot of it was around the kind of mindset piece. And actually, how do you change mindsets? Like Tanzania, I spent a lot of time with Maasai. Maasai tribes, traditionally, that it's very much your wealth, your kind of societal status is based on how many cattle you own. So it's very much this idea that the Maasai people, they hoard and build their cattle herds. But these cattle aren't productive cattle that enter the food chain after, you know, 1 or 2 years. They just keep on to their cattle because it's this sign of sort of wealth and status. And what they're having is massive issues with poaching of ground, and there's land conflicts happening in conservation areas with elephants and wildlife. So human wildlife conflict was a massive issue over there, but problems with the soil because they're overgrazing. Yeah. And I met with people, some amazing Tanzanian farmers who are trying to pass on knowledge to some Maasai to say, you know, you can introduce certain genetics and you can fatten the cattle at a shorter age. They can go to slaughter and then you can make more money from your cattle. You can actually make money because they're entering the food chain for a start. You can help take your kids to school. So there are people there that are just doing the whole mindset piece around demonstrating what is possible. Because we couldn't even imagine that here, the idea of, you know, having cattle and they don't enter the food chain. So you're having to start often with a very different way and approach. So it's not just like, what can we do to improve our soils? It's how do we get people on board first? And how do we show that by doing X, Y, and Z, we can help get kids to school, alleviate poverty, and then we can start looking at soil. So the conversation sequence is very different.
I think that's the challenging thing for these countries where they've got such a important cultural history that you don't want to disregard. But at the same time, you know, they're obviously aware of the conflicts with wildlife and livestock management. And for the Maasai, having cattle, as you say, is a status thing rather than for earning money. But equally, if they're in poverty, I can just imagine the conflict and the difficulty that these countries have in trying to manage all the pressures and then adding in climate change and biodiversity loss. I think in the UK, we're probably guilty of, you know, complaining about the weather. We've just had a dry spell. We've got rain now. We're recording this in May. We had a terribly wet, cold spring. Then we've had a dry few weeks and the arable farmers were all a bit happier. And now we're saying, oh, we need a bit of rain. Now we've got rain again. And my husband's saying, I need to get on spraying. And I think it's just that removal from it being a more of a daily inconvenience or a few weeks where things aren't going great to them having, you know, global, not global, you know, countrywide issues with climate, as you're saying, if they're overgrazing and it's just such a big impact, isn't it? Worldwide climate and biodiversity.
It is. And it's been fascinating for me because I just don't know what I was expecting. But I think it's particularly being in developing countries. It's like what I was saying, like the conversation, it's different. And it's like, I remember I went to this massive, one of the biggest avocado plantations in Kenya, and they had thousands and thousands of employees, but their responsibility as the the farmer who was managing that plantation was they had to provide education and healthcare and security. There was places I went where maybe a quarter of their budget was in security because people are stealing, or as people are starving. So they're, you know, they're entering property and they're stealing, or murder and lots of different things. And you just think, wow, it's people are having to think about so many different issues. And in Zimbabwe, I ended up down in an absolute tunnel looking at gender rights. That ended up being a big, so I didn't even mention that earlier, because I spoke to farmers who were having issues with some of the, they had schools for their workers, and young women were turning 14 or 15 and being sold off into child marriages. And I was like, I cannot believe I'm having a conversation. And this was a big part of my conversations. And you just think, wow, you know, they're dealing with so many other different issues around gender, and we don't even begin to imagine. So they are looking at building their climate resilience, and biodiversity in parts of Africa was just outstanding in terms of some of the wildlife and the treescapes that I witnessed. But it's they're focusing on building security and, you know, poverty and different. So you just begin to realize we are quite privileged in Europe because we can really focus on climate and biodiversity, because the rest of it, in many phases, of course, we still have issues around poverty and things like that too, but most people aren't going hungry on a daily basis. The majority aren't. But in some of these, and in Zimbabwe, I remember a farmer said to me, once a month, a family might get access to protein. Wow. And he said, when I offered my staff more money, this is working on his pig farm, they said, please don't give us more money. It doesn't mean anything because of inflation. It means absolutely nothing to us. Just give us meat parcels. So when people have conversations with me after saying, you know, it's terrible, we're importing food from countries where, they, you know, people have such poor wages, it's still, you know, because we associate our value and our worth and how we go about society with our wages often, whereas for many of these workers, their education, their shelter, their fuel, their food is taken care of by the company, that is part of their earning, is being employed in that job. And this happens, farming plays this massive, it's quite like talking about farmers being heroes in parts of Africa where there's a lot of corruption with governments and, you know, that money isn't going into public services. Farming provides a public service to people. And you just think, wow, like they're having to provide so much more and to actually actively choose for meat parcels over more money. It actually made me cry. I found that really like, wow, that was quite a confronting moment for me that you just suddenly think. And I think the reason the guy brought it up with me is because he'd seen me on the BBC talking about, should we be reducing meat consumption and production? And he'd said to me, you're all very privileged. And he was quite confronting about it. He said, the fact you're saying that, and we literally here have such issues with malnourishment, access to protein is a privilege. And when you're traveling and for weeks and weeks in places like that, you just begin to really question yourself. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's eye-opening, and it sounds like you've learned a lot from that. In the UK and in Scotland at the moment particularly, we're coming into a period of change. So our subsidy system's changing. There's a lot of political change happening at the moment, which I won't go into. But for farmers, that can be a bit unsettling. And it's not on the same scale as some of the countries and some of the issues that you've been describing. But nevertheless, it's what we as farmers in the UK know. And we've had a period where we've had basic payments since 2015. Now we're coming to something different and we're transitioning. How do you think farmers can prepare for that change?
I think the first thing I would say is I think farmers have every right still to feel what they're nervous or upset about is matters. And that's something I would say, yes, that was a very different circumstance that I described in Africa. But the uncertainty that's faced farmers here, uncertainty is crippling. And not knowing, when farming is such a long-term game, and on top of that, you have obviously weather challenges, you have input costs rising, you have changes in the market that you can't control. Everything for a farmer in general, you can't control. And that's very, very difficult. And I'll never take that away from farming here. So, which is why I understand when farmers take to the streets, and whether I have views, I do have different views on it, but I understand that core need to feel like they need answers and being heard. For what I would probably say, it's hard because I've been in most countries I've been into, pretty much all of them have not been subsidy based. So I've learned quite a lot about what it's like farming without subsidies. And in New Zealand's interesting. I know we talk about New Zealand a lot in Scotland because we see that there's a country that had the subsidies removed. the subsidy removal in New Zealand happened pretty much overnight. Mm-hmm. When the Labour government came in, it happened overnight in the 80s, and it was very crippling for farmers at that time. And I think around 3% of businesses went out. And the businesses that went out were businesses who had heavily borrowed, and there was other businesses that maybe weren't very efficient either, that couldn't really adapt. But it was still very, very challenging. I know they had a surge in suicides, and it was a really awful time for New Zealand. And then they had that huge change into everyone went dairy farming, because that's where they could get cash flow and people really needed that. And that's why they've had that boom. No farmer I spoke to, and I spoke to probably, I mean, in New Zealand, probably up to 100 farmers, no farmer regretted it.
Okay.
They all said at the time it was challenging, but that period of adaption has allowed them to really focus on their business, focus on profitability, efficiency, understanding the market, being more aware of like customers and needs. So that was the thing. And then they said, well, what will happen with yourself is you will have more of a transition. So it's being able to wean yourself off slightly over that time to being, how can I really build that resilience into my business? So when it does happen, I am ready for that. You've got to keep an eye on it and what's happening. It's how can we prepare in the meantime to streamline and change the businesses where we can, so we are independent, because things can change and go. How can we stand on our own feet as much as we can? And that's really hard to ask somebody to do when someone who's been born in a time when all they've known is payments. And I really get that. And that's really challenging. But I think it's about what can we do to look at other examples around the world and actually think about the market and think about how we can adjust and adapt, because already farmers here, it's amazing some of the adaption that's already happening around changing genetics and just in generally like sort of streamlining businesses and removing low performing animals. Like, there's so many things people are already doing, but it's about just sort of accelerating that and not waiting for the detail to come, because it just seems to be taking forever here.
Alongside all that, improving up the current enterprises that farmers have got, I was reading an article you wrote recently about diversification and agritourism, and how some farmers or members of the public, you know, globally might see that a farm that's diversified is not truly farming anymore, or somehow they've failed at farming because they're needing to subsidize their income, and, you know, they're maybe not proper farmers anymore because they've become so diversified. I was reading, you know, you'd visited, is it Hobbiton in New Zealand,
a little
Lord of the Rings village? It looked pretty cool. Can you tell us your views on that? How do you feel about people saying that farms that have diversified are not truly farming anymore?
I think when there's that generational idea of we've farmed this way for 9 or 10 generations, it can seem like a failure if you're the generation that has to do something different because you didn't make that system work. And that's something, sadly, that we've inherited. That is that idea that's still there, whereas those new generation farmers don't have that tie. They don't have that legacy to uphold. So I really empathize why people feel like that. It's more by being able to actually witness the potential that you can have. You can still be farming. You have to be an agritourism business. The mainstay has to be the farm. It has to be the agricultural side of the practice, but you're sort of extending that diversification arm into a new avenue. So I just wish we could move away from not seeing it as failure, but seeing it as opportunity. And there's opportunities. There's so many there. I mean, we talk about that idea of that, you know, you're providing multiple income streams. So you could have more people coming into the farm. You can look to have more people coming into rural communities. So you're actually building those fabrics of rural communities, that you're providing a community service, yeah, and you're strengthening your own purse as well. But when I wrote the article, the reason I wrote it, and I guess in my topic, looking at turning the tide on the anti-farming agenda, I just think agritourism does such a service to agriculture that we don't often give it recognition for. So whether you're someone that is quite critical of the kind of income side of it or not, just if you're purely to look at it through the premise of every time a tourist, whether it's 500 or 500 coming onto a farm every year, or whether it's 500,000 going to Hobbiton in New Zealand, those people, those individuals who are being met by that farmer are hearing positives. They are hearing about what their relationship is with their business, with the different practices on the farm. Often it's about the custodianship, the soil, biodiversity there. I mean, I've been to so many agritourism experiences and I always come away feeling really proud of farming. And when I went to Hobbiton, I didn't even think about Hobbiton as an agritourism experience, which is why I wrote about it. I literally got onto this bus with 40 other tourists from all over the world, because we all had to share where we'd been, where we were coming from. So Brazilians, Germans, like there's people everywhere. And they did a 10-minute video where they said the reason you're here today is because the Alexander family, they've given part of their farm to hosting Hobbiton as a film set for you to come and visit. And then they talked about what they farmed, and that, so it's a beef and sheep farm. They talked about how the farm has changed and responded to different climates. They give you the history and the story, and you heard from the farmers. Mm-hmm. And then as you went around the Hobbiton and saw these amazing hobbit holes, and it was absolutely, I mean, I was crying all day because I'm a massive Lord of the Rings and Hobbit. It was just blue skies. It was beautiful. I'm just such an emotional person. It was incredible. Then I got back on the bus and it was like another 10 minutes. Let's thank the farmers. I had to do a round of applause. We talked about like going away from this and understanding their relationship. I just thought, what an amazing advert and service. 500,000 people who've all gone away thinking, God, farmers are doing something really amazing. And if every agritourism business, whether it's 2 people, 1,000, 100, you just suddenly think when you accumulate those numbers of people that are being told positive stories, and it is positive, who is going to say to a tourist coming to their farm, it's just really crap here, you know, because they're not going to do that, because they are front facing, they are welcoming them to the place that they love to work, and they're wanting to show the best of it. So, and often the people in agritourism, they're doing it because they want to have a relationship with the public. They see the importance of that. They're that shot window for agriculture. So whether, if you don't do agritourism, totally fine. I would never, there's a lot of people I would advise not to do agritourism. They're probably not the best advert for agriculture because we're not all great with the public, and that's totally fine. But those that are, we should be like very grateful because they are doing such a service, especially absolutely on the narrative piece.
Absolutely. I think that's really nice to hear your experience in New Zealand there, that they were so focused on the farming at the start and at the end. It just reminds people about agriculture in the country. Aside from agritourism experiences, if we talk about Scotland, what can we as Scottish farmers do to tell a more positive farming story, do you think?
What I would say is I do think there's a lot of people in Scotland who are very positive and they are telling amazing stories. But I think we need to think about where we're directing our energy and who our audience is, where are those stories going to? And I think we do spend quite a lot of time, you know, at conferences, I hear the most wonderful presentations and I think, God, this is incredible. I want all my friends who are doctors and teachers and artists, I want them to hear these stories, but they're not there. So now what I've started picking up as I've been moving around is who's not in the room, who's not hearing these stories, because they are often the ones that matter. So the biggest thing that I probably would say is that we need to get much better actually where we're directing it. So that could be joining local committees in your local village. That isn't just about agriculture. If you're going to get on your tractor and join a protest around, you know, some of the protests you've seen recently, also join a protest that isn't just about agriculture. Join a climate justice protest. Join one around education, and show that farmers are not just creating this silo where they're separate from everybody. What we tend to do is we do keep ourselves to ourselves quite a bit. I don't think there's a rural-urban divide. I don't think there's a divide or an agenda between, but there's a disconnection between the two, and it's about how do we integrate better. And I think one of the most important things we can do is remove this idea of needing to educate people, because we do not need to educate the public about farming, but we should see it as like our real opportunity to engage. So I'm like, let's not educate, let's take the opportunity to engage. That would be a massive message for me. Mm-hmm. That's a two-way street. So it's got to be both sides willing, listening. And when you're hearing things and people are giving their opinion, like take it on board. And if there's something around asking questions about why you do something the way you do, think about it and think, oh, that's interesting. Don't just think, well, they come from a town, what do they know? Well, they're really important because they're the customers. Yeah. So they, you know, at the end of the day, what does a customer really want? They want to know your animals are well looked after. They want to know your waterways are looked after, your soils. They don't need all the detail. They don't need all of that. They just need to know they trust you and they value you. So building that trust and showing that you respect them in return, that's really important for me. So I guess in summary, that is the probably thing. It's who are we directing messages to when we're sending them out? Adapting the language so it's accessible, and not leaving people out of those conversations, because we can be really bad at doing that. Engaging, not educating, and then moving out of those circles so we're not always just speaking to ourselves. There's some sort of real kind of, I think they're quite easy things to do, and everybody can do it in different ways. I'm not asking everyone to go out and speak at a health conference as a presenter. Not everyone's going to do that, but we can all do little things and have conversations with people, or when we're in supermarkets. I just think there's little things that cumulatively, a bit like the agritourism example, I think cumulatively we can all do a little bit more to sort of bring that connection a little bit closer together again.
Absolutely. You summarised that so nicely there, Claire. I'm just thinking about your Nuffield scholarship again. When you've finished all your research and brought your thoughts together, is there going to be some sort of article that we can all read and get all your wisdom? Because there was lots of really good advice in there.
I've been thinking quite a lot about what I'm going to do at the end of that, at the end of this, because we have to prepare a policy paper, and I have done 14 countries in 8 months, and I've got to write 5,000 words. And I'm not even going to scratch the surface, really. Even all what I've been sharing on social media, I've probably only shared about 5%. And even you and I have talked about lots a day because we've had, up to an hour to talk. But most opportunities, you don't get much time.
Yeah.
And you're missing out on all these things. I'm trying to think about what to do. So I'm going to hopefully speak at a few conferences and do some presentations. If I had my dream, I would love to do something where I could travel around and have meetings with farmers or discussion groups or go to auction marts and actually share some stories, but not just me talking, but like do sort of like a kind of, a back and forth with farmers and take questions. I'd love to do something like that because I've given 3 presentations so far. We're not really meant to until we submit, but I've done a few and I've shared stories about Zimbabwe and Kenya and Argentina and Brazil, and farmers have loved it. They've loved just hearing about how people are farming differently, because we are naturally, I think farmers are very curious.
Yeah.
We often are isolated. We don't have the time to take off the farm. And we don't always have the time to go to a conference. And we can be very guilty sometimes at only delivering presentations at major conferences. And then who gets to hear? It's the same people. So if I had my absolute dream at the end of this, it would be, how do I speak to people that wouldn't otherwise get an opportunity to access it and share some ideas? Because even like the advice I sort of shared there, Mary Jane, that might not suit every farmer in Scotland. But if I was, in a group of 20 people going back and forth, we could discuss between us what could they do differently to give them confidence,
yeah,
and to feel they could build trust. So I'd love to do something a little bit more interactive and share examples. But I'm still in the process of thinking about what I'm going to do with it.
I think today's been fantastic, Claire. You've spoken so well. And for those people that are able to listen to podcasts, and a lot of our listeners obviously are farmers, it's a great time when they're going out in their tractor or out and about doing work, often on their own for a lot of the time of the day. The podcast is a great accessible way for a lot of people to be able to hear what you've done, and what the work that you're doing sounds fantastic. And I can't wait to see what comes next.
I totally agree. I think they're one of the most amazing opportunities to learn, because written form, we don't often have time, but you're right. I think most people I've spoken to, because I've got a podcast I'm launching shortly, I just haven't had time yet.
Yeah.
And that is going to share some of those intricate conversations that I've had, so people can pick a country and say, oh, this is Zimbabwe this week. We'll hear what she's done there. And they can have a bit more time and they can pick and choose. And that's why I think podcasts are they're absolutely phenomenal when it comes to that knowledge exchange.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Claire. We'll put a link to your podcast when it goes live in the show notes. And thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Agriculture. If you'd like to get in touch or find out more about the Nuffield Farming Scholarship, you can find links in the show notes. This episode was presented by me, Mary Jane Laurie, produced by Kerry Hammond, and edited by Ross McKenzie in association with the Scottish Government.
The Farm Advisory Service Podcast. Audio advice on livestock, crops and soils, environment, rural business, and more. Brought to you in association with the Scottish Government.